This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. Today's guests represent a kind of brewery that lives, sometimes tenuously, in the spaces in between traditional brewery models in American craft brewing. They're very small, of course, and they have an alternating proprietorship arrangement with another local brewery, also very small, which means that they use that brewery system to brew their beer, but on that particular brew day, they technically own the license. They brew, package, and sell that beer via self-distribution, and their portfolio, for reasons both of constraint, personal interest, and identity, is hyper-focused on hazy IPA, double IPA, and adjunct stouts. While the growth in craft brewing slows, and 2019 looks to be a bit topsy-turvy for many folks, a brewery like this could either be seen as exceptionally vulnerable or crazy like a fox. They have low overhead, even if expenses are relatively high due to small volumes. They have a strong alt-prop relationship with a good local brewer, but that means they're also dependent on someone else's brewery stability. And they have a great brand and profile in Chicago, but there's always somebody new coming for their share of the pie. So how do they balance all that uncertainty while also finding the mental energy to be creative, connect with their fans, and explore the nerdier side of hoppy beers that seem to consistently delight them and their drinkers? This is Jude and Jeremiah from Hop Butcher for the World, a beer company. Listen in. Citra and Sabo. Tell me about Sabo.
Super new hop. Do you remember what it was called? HPC, was it 438?
Yeah.
So always on the hunt for new hops. So we were interested in this one when it was just a number, but around the time of CBC, they announced that it had a name. So it comes from the same groups. What is it? Barth Haas and Select Botanicals.
Okay.
Who gave us Citra, Mosaic.
Which was like 394, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Simcoe, Equinot, Laurel. So from that line of hops or that family of hops, or the people behind it.
Yeah.
So then this was the latest one. And there's a bittering one as well, but this is the aroma and flavor hop called Sabro. So big flavors of like tangerine. There's a lot of coconut water in there, swear to God.
Okay.
I describe it as just a super lush kind of melon. They say you can look for cedar and mint and creamy.
Interesting.
But knowing what...
There's definitely like a wood tanning quality that I could see sort of like a cedar coming through. And
the coconut qualities that we got out of that, we thought back in the day we were going to get that out of cashmere. So we jumped on cashmere right away. We put it in a beer called Watch for Falling Coconuts and then slowly but surely learned that we weren't actually getting a whole lot of coconut. So we approached Sabro with a very skeptical eye.
Yeah,
But even on brew day... Like, as soon as it was going in the whirlpool, we were getting coconut.
Yeah, I mean, the coconut water specifically as a descriptor is really accurate for this one. Yeah. It's funny how, like, we often talk about drinkers and the power of suggestion when it comes to tasting, but it took a while for the power of suggestion to wear off for you with the cashmere. Even on the brewing side, sometimes you're just like, at some point you have to admit, you're like, I'm not getting what I wanted out of this.
No matter how many times you try and force it. No, it's there.
Sabro's inspired a potential hop change too in that beer because it's called Watch for Falling Coconuts.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, if we're getting coconuts out of Sabro and we get coconuts out of 472, which doesn't have a name yet, like, why wouldn't we use that? So we're constantly... not only chasing down new hops like Sabro, but looking at our beers from a recipe perspective and like, how can we be more literal or how can we be more figurative or how can we improve this beer and make it more of what we intended? So,
well, this is great. This isn't where I thought we were going to start, but I want to jump right in because it's where one of the things I eventually wanted to jump into, which was a lot of people who see breweries like Hop Butcher who, you know, are emerging into these brewers who are known for just making like one IPA after another, after another, after another. And there's some folks that see that and they kind of just see a blur of sameness, right? Mm-hmm. But on the brewing side, and that's often the case with something kind of new,
right?
Especially kind of when it's investigative almost. But from the brewing side of things, like it always strikes me when I meet brewers like yourselves or like somebody like Bissell Brothers or somebody like there's such an academic approach to what it is they're doing with those hops that, like, sure, nuance between one versus the other, maybe, but important nuance for you.
Right.
Yeah.
What is that about? Like, what is that investigative process like for you guys when you're thinking about the next hop you want to use and why and what you're ultimately going to get out of it?
I think that we started this way out of curiosity and having a long list of hops and combinations thereof that we wanted to try. You know, at the time we only had one tank, so the whole releasing a new beer every month kind of became a necessity. Yeah. Otherwise, we weren't going to get to do anything else. And that list got big in a hurry. And
what were some of the things that were at the top of that first list?
I mean, some obvious ones that we couldn't necessarily do, like Nelson and Galaxy. Okay. You know, we wanted to use Galaxy in the beginning, but we didn't have it. But we took out a contract, and then we had to wait for that to hit. We ended up borrowing some and then paying it back as soon as we got ours, which was Galaxy Bowl. That was the first time we had ever used Galaxy.
Okay.
I don't know. What else was at the very top?
I mean, it would have been Citra, Mosaic. Yeah. Mosaic was new at the time, probably out of like a Great Lakes brew. It was the first time I ever had Mosaic. Simcoe was, I mean, Spiteful was rolling out, I think, Alley Time. And that was the first time I had heard of Simcoe.
Yeah, I think same for me, I think.
Eldorado. Pipers
was rolling out Ninjas with cool hops. Eldorado for sure, too.
I mean, that was the world that you guys were born
coming
into.
Yeah, like you
were coming into, you know, the Pipeworks of the world and smaller producers kind of playing around with, you know, these largely unknown hops that were just starting to get their name out there. And you guys sort of kind of went down that rabbit hole, and you're still going down that rabbit
hole.
I mean, this is what, 3 years in ish.
We sold our first beer in March of 2015.
Yeah. A little over so about almost four then.
What
is it about this rabbit hole that is still interesting to you that like you still talk about it with like interest?
Right. Well, I mean, I think and it's part of the answer of your last question as well too. So it's maybe not so much the new hop that's coming out, but after a while kind of censoring out the tried and trues now, like the Citros and the Mosaics, and kind of running through those. And I think we always try and say, even though it's very difficult to do, like we're trying to hit on new flavors and aromas or new flavor type expressions. And, you know, most of the time, maybe with Citra and Mosaic, you're going to get the same one, but we're always geeked out and excited to hit on the new one. Like that very first moment that you smelled all these hops we were describing, they stick with you. So we're always hunting that new flavor. And I think it's as much as we drink a lot of beer and we love hops. So we know what that feeling's like for ourselves. We're seeking those beers out. We want to be able to create that as much for others as ourselves and ourselves for others.
Yeah, we want to experiment, but we also know what our safe plays are. You know, your Citra and Mosaic, to his point, tried and true. So, like, we'll slowly but surely fall in love with certain hops. Obviously, Galaxy, Citra and Mosaic are there, but then along comes Vic Secret. And then that moves from, oh, this is new and we haven't used it yet, to we used it once, we learned what we got, now we feel good. Like, let's do Citra and Vic Secret, let's do Mosaic and Vic Secret, let's do Eldorado Vic Secret. And then along comes Strata, you know, which at one point was OSU 331. We rubbed it, we got really excited about it, but even more excited after we were able to try it in a brew. Same thing, let's do Strata and Citra, let's do Strata and Mosaic. And
so you're kind of using those almost as controls then.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
And then from there, you know, if Jude and I are like, hey, that 2016 Simcoe really gets us excited, or that 17 or 18 Citra, then we'll actually try to target specific crops too if we have experience with, and I guess availability. If we can get them, then we'll try to dial it in even further.
That's going to be a constant source of complexity for you, is access to the ingredients, because you're not operating at a huge level. I mean, you're still a very tiny brewery. But your interest level in specific agriculture is very demanding.
Jude mentioned hunting down new hops, which equals me constantly pounding our spot and our suppliers with emails saying, hey, do you have this yet? Do you have this yet? Do you have this yet? What about this? Where's the Sabro? And like, maybe we should send them a Christmas card and a fruit basket at the end of the year, but they know why we're doing what we're doing, and we try to help share some beer so they get to taste that end product too, especially the smaller farmers that are providing specific varietals like Strata, because we get that from a specific farmer who is the one answering the email, who is also creating the invoice, which is obviously a lot different than your Country Malt Groups, your BSGs, your Crosbys. So,
how short of a window do you have when you find something like that you like and you really want it, and you're talking to that farmer, and everybody else finds it too?
Are
you pulling triggers pretty quick to get it? Like, do you feel the anxiety of the moment of like, I better get this or it's gone?
Yes, it's varied over the years, but I think there have been some specific instances where we used it like immediately. You know, it landed, we used it the next day. Vic Secret's probably one of them, and then up goes the contract. Strata was a pretty quick falling in love with, but there are other ones that we'll order to rub and we won't, you know, we'll sit on them for a while. Like, we have some experimentals that are still in our cooler that we just haven't found the right avenue for.
Vic's Secret had been used in other beers, and we had seen it being used, but I think until we first experienced it and we were like, whoa, like, this Vic's Secret's awesome, where it was like, let's go, let's get on it, let's get on it. And then kind of wondering why, like, we immediately said, let's go, let's inquire about it. And it was available. And then a little more was available. So we were kind of wondering, like, why this is something that people should be hopping on. But yeah. Something like Sabro, we hopped on that right away when we found out it was going to be, it wasn't just experimental and it was commercial, but we were shut up. And we were, that was last April.
Yeah.
And then it was just a constant staying on it. And then maybe come last month or the last two, it was like, now it's available. You know, you're at the mercy of like what the descriptors are. So, I mean, I think like from like a discovery process, you take a look at if they can supply like information on like oil content and what type of oils, and you go and you compare that to other hops that you like. And there's so much research or information that still has to come out. I mean, I feel like as much information that's out on hop oils, I feel like no one knows what the F is going on, right? So for us, I don't know if we're right in doing it, but we just try to compare it to our sensory mm-hmm. and other things that we know we like and say, all right, so it's high in myrcene or it's high in carophyllene, and so is this other one, and maybe that's what we like out of it.
So you're basically trying to take these descriptors, match it up with sensory, and yep. then trying to match that to the analysis of it.
Sure.
Yep. To try and learn some sort of pattern over time of what your preferences are and why.
Absolutely. Yep. Yep. Okay. And you got to keep your ear to the ground. I mean, you Instagram helps, so you see what other breweries around the country are doing. Mm-hmm. So even if we look at each other and we say we want to use this hop, sometimes you need that outside kind of validation, like, oh, they're using it, so mm-hmm. that's all I needed now to like go ahead and do it. Mm. And then you go ahead and do it, but I feel like, you know, it's important that we keep our ears to the ground. The breweries in the local breweries here that use it, if we see that they have it out, I mean, we'll go and we'll pick up those beers and
yeah.
and we'll drink them and we'll say, all right, here it is. So a lot of time it's come from that, somebody around here that would have used it. Said, we can do this. We could use this one.
There's an element of Geronimo in what we do too, though. Like, I think we have a certain yeah. subset of people who do buy and enjoy our beers that appreciate, like, oh, I've never heard of this hop. Cool. You know, like, this is the first time they're trying or tasting something. And
there's a certain percentage of our listeners right now that think Geronimo is a hop.
Strata is like the recent obsession, and Sabro is quickly becoming.
That's one still in development.
But, you know, there's a sense of pride too in being the first brewery in Chicago to use Strata, if yeah. we were, right? Yeah. Or any, you know, insert hop name. That's cool.
What are you guys doing to capture all of this sort of emerging knowledge and these patterns that you're seeking? Like, how do you... Is it just between the two of you? Like, it just lives in your heads, or are you documenting it in a certain way to kind of like be able to review things over time and like learn from the analysis? What are you doing to amass knowledge?
Drink a lot.
If someone opened up our separate notepads yeah. or notebooks, I think, you know, I don't know, I'd go as far as saying, like, you know, that scene in A Brilliant Mind where he's writing on all the windows. I don't know that I'd go that far, but I think each of us kind of take copious notes in our own different ways.
Yeah.
And it's not just us two. It's also Justin, our brewer. Mm-hmm. You know, we take input from Ben, our delivery and packaging guy, too. Like, he's the one that's working the line, yeah. you know, when we can it up. So he's drinking it. And, hey, what do you think? And then, you know, we take the beer home. We watch Untappd to see what people think. People are tweeting at us. And
so, like, you, like, roll those out and yeah. then, like, go home and watch Untappd all day.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about all day, but, you know, if you happen to check it before you go to bed at night just to see how people are taking it, it can be exciting.
Yeah.
We have three children apiece, so to be able to yeah. do that all the time would draw some eyes, I think, in the household. We have to give credit to Justin Miller, our brewer. Us three and us four, really. We're just a team of four. We're pretty passionate about beer. We're passionate about making beer. We're really passionate about drinking beer. Not just our beer, but others' beer.
Yeah.
Going through that, one, to talk about Justin. I mean, Justin loves hops, and Justin likes a lot of other styles. So It's talking to him or him sharing it. I mean, it's a conversation about just beer in general that's always happening. If we have something outside of our brewery that we really like, and we'll make sure we get in each other's hands and we'll talk about that type of stuff and what we liked. I think, like, personally for myself and just drinking a lot of beer, those memories stick with you. And you try and keep your nose in the glass and say, this is what I like and this is what I like. And it's always a quick text to these guys that say, like, hey, I'll either hold you one or, you know, go out and get it yourself and tell me what we think. But we're always talking about flavors. So yeah, we'll pick out one or two flavors, I think, or aromas that we get in hops and say, oh, this would really work well with so-and-so.
Yeah.
Millions of text messages, I'd say.
I mean, as much as you guys are sort of, it sounds like you're pretty in touch with what it's like to still be a craft beer fan and a craft beer drinker, right? Yeah. As much as you are producers. So let's revisit that idea of sort of like flavor threshold then. Because for folks who are not really invested in these kinds of beers, right? Like these like kind of like hazy, juicy, hoppy beers, they don't necessarily they're not really looking at the nuance between each release as much as somebody who is really up on what you guys are doing and following closely. How do you guys think about the sort of the perception threshold from one beer to a next? Like, do you try and create contrast? Do you like it that they kind of have a similar kind of, you know, they're in a similar vein? How do you think about that? And how do you think about the customer that you're selling these to?
I think a big part of it, I would say, is one, the storytelling that's probably going to go behind it. I think that when we set out, we said like, hey, we love hops so much. And instead of making a bunch of different beers, it would be nice for people to say like, hey, when I think of hops, I want to go one or two or three different places. So yeah, I think we thought it would be great to be able to be known as that and try and achieve that. And when it comes to like differentiating or how we'd be perceived kind of in the mind of the people drinking our beer is, let's do it on hops. And I feel like it's got to kind of come downline from like our passion and our drinking of the beer and our sensory, and we've got to be able to relay why we're so excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
So we try and differentiate on hops, and the way that we'll select them is, you know, this would be great if it had a really like underlying dank element, but a big citrus element. Or, you know what, Galaxy is very grassy in this way, and this is just one note pineapple. So it would be great to have. So I think we're kind of like abstractly going through things in our head, and we're confident that it could stand out from brew to brew just on the hops.
Yeah.
And we've built the grist around that too, letting those hops paint that picture, because I feel like there were some instances along the way where maybe we felt like some malt sweetness was getting in the way, where you still got that hop complexity, but maybe that we felt like a bag of honey or, you know, a bag of this or that was maybe covering that up too much. And then we'd back off and really try to drive that home, you know, so where we wanted to decide pleasant dank and a little bit of pine or a little bit of pineapple, or hey, this one's really banging some tangerine, that our grist would allow us to do that. So we continue to try and refine that. And then that changes by the style, even between pale IPA and double IPA. Like we've found you can't just double that if you're making a double, you can't triple that if you're making a triple. Like we're constantly tweaking and dialing that in. I almost said twerking.
Yeah, and I think
that would have been dangerous.
Well, like, you could have kept that to yourself. It would have been fine.
Never mind. Yeah, we'll talk about that later. But I think that we agreed that there's a million of combinations out there, and we're not going to stop until we hit on every one. And that's the exciting thing is that there are six extremely banging hops out there, right? Those can be combined in any hop in any combination, and I feel it's going to produce a different flavor.
The closest parallel I have for it, that, and I think you'll connect with this because I know you guys pay attention to coffee pretty closely as well, is when I was first sort of getting my taste and understanding of somebody like Intelligentsia, right? And I would go and I would do cuppings, and I would pick up nuances, you know, when we were doing analysis or cuppings with them. Like they would talk about what they were getting, and I could sort of connect that with what I was tasting, but it was hard, like pairing a vocabulary to what I was tasting. Because in the grand scheme of things, if you take a couple steps back, you're like, well, it all just tastes like coffee to a degree. Right. And like the variables are very slight. And it's not really until you start investing in the drinking experience and the tasting experience of that, comparing one to another relatively quickly. If you're coming every day to Intelli, you'll notice when, you know, the coffee seasonality changes, and you'll get something slightly different, sometimes more or less. that strikes me as a kind of similar experience that a lot of people have with their, if they generally like IPAs and they're just sort of drinking around casually, they might not notice some of the nuances between one or another release.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But they will know the difference between what's delicious to them and what's not. And that's kind of where I remember when I was first drinking Hop Butcher beers, that my first experiences were, these are always delicious, right? And I would get excited about that. And so I always had this confidence and excitement about whatever was next. But it wasn't until much later that I started to really remember the nuances between some of them, because they're, you know, the similarity is really powerful in creating this overall effect of like, I like these beers,
right?
Like I'm always going to like this brand. But after a while, you start to pick up on the nuances, start to develop preferences for one or another, or you're just interested in the difference right. between one or another.
Yeah. And it depends, I think, like how far you want to go and how, yeah. and however far you want to go is fine. And specifically, I think talking about like the people that would pick up our beers and drink it. So like if on the, just the very kind of like first level, or introductory or however, if you just kind of want to keep it where I like this, that's totally cool. But I think, you know, also if you want to go a little bit deeper and maybe even from like an educational standpoint or just further kind of like diving down the rabbit hole. And I think, you know, you appreciate it, like from a coffee standpoint, I think we do as well. If you want to learn more, and you want to start looking for the subtleties, we think it's great as well. And I think that we're here to suggest what else is out there. And I think in our own experience, whether it's been in coffee or beer or in wine, once we may have come in and said, I get this and I get this, but then someone else suggested something else. And I said, I see what you mean. Mm-hmm. And that geeks you out like that. And if you're down for that, then that kind of like flips a switch and it takes you on the next level. And now you've experienced it. And then you're looking for it the next time, or the next time it does pop up, you associate it with something else.
Yeah.
That's, I think, one of the gnarliest things about beer or anything that you enjoy or that you decide to go further into, is you could take it wherever you want. Every level is fine.
And a big driver between why our cans are designed the way they are too, when you flip them around, you got tasting notes.
And that's
like
another
if
part
you
too,
if you don't want to dive in and you just want to know on the surface what it's going to taste like, you can find that out before you even buy it, which is cool.
Yeah.
Whereas on the front, when you look at how we list our hops and ABV, hops are obviously not a TTB requirement. Mm-hmm. ABV to some degree is. We've had a couple accounts actually come back to us and say, I'm so happy that you guys list the hops that you guys use, because people are starting to, like, new drinkers are starting to have an understanding of what hops they like.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's cool, not only for us as brewers, but for accounts as retailers, to be able to say, like, oh, that guy, you know, he's been coming here for 2 years, and now he knows what the Eldorado hop means. You know, he knows.
And you're also giving them a platform with, like, as you described, like, a pretty, like, neutral grist on that. Like, yep. They can believe that what they like about that beer are these, you know, this particular hop combo.
Exactly.
Whereas if they, you know, if you were changing the malt bill a lot or even process tweaks, like, they could get to a point where they don't know if they like that or not, which would be problematic. Like, you're providing some clarity.
Well, you're keeping you're eliminating the multiple variables and you just bring it down to one.
And
or
we
two.
Talk about that a lot from the brewing side, but we don't necessarily talk about that from the drinker side all that
right,
much.
Right.
Like, you're creating a platform of which the hops are the thing that you can remember and trust in.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's kind of interesting.
I mean, I feel this, we released a beer this week called Neon Green Relish, where we used that hop that we were talking about earlier called Sabro, and it's Citra and Sabro. And we know what Citra gives. Mm-hmm. And the first time that we smelled the beer and tasted it, we were like, whoa. And we know what Citra provides. So in my mind, or in our mind, excuse me, anything else it was giving off was all that hop. So I feel it's as educational for us, and then we're able to relay that to others and get them excited about it. But I mean, perfect example, what you're talking about is that right there.
Yeah. Cool. Now I want to go back to where I thought I was going to start.
Nice. You know, one thing I would say too is, like, and we also try, like, from beer to beer, I mean, we try and create an expectation, I think, with the name. I feel like in this abstract way, the name kind of matches what we have in mind for the hops or the flavor.
Okay.
And I feel like the visuals as well and the artwork help kind of separate it and create an image. And I'd say, like, if we really could distill down anything, I mean, as beer drinkers, we love beer that excites us. You know, we see that something comes out that we want to get into we get excited about that. So I think we're into making exciting beers.
Yeah.
So as abstract as that sounds, when we read hops with descriptors or the prospects of throwing those in a beer, that gets us excited. So if as long as it nets out in the end that this is an exciting beer, and that's what we always tell people, like, this is why we're in it. This is what we want to provide to you, or this is what we promise, is we're always going to try and be exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I've always found you guys to be, on that note, I've always found you to be kind of more in touch with who your drinker is, because you are your drinker in a lot of ways. Like the attitude and the things that you're interested in, and like the energy that you guys have, is very much, it reminds me of the people who are also fans of you. Like, you're very similar people looking for similar things. And it seems like it's working really well.
Right. I'm sorry for interrupting you.
No, not at all. Yeah. Let's jump back in time a little bit. When we're on our way in here, you both sort of mentioned separately the first time we had sort of like crossed paths. And with you, it was actually at Intelligentsia, the Wicker Park one. You came for an Uppers and Downers thing when we were dipping cascara in cider, and Five Rabbit was there making some like crazy desserty kind of things.
Going down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. And Paul Schneider, who was the brewer at Salamoth at the time, was there with a bunch of different beers, including a coffee Kolsch.
Yeah.
And you at Salamoth is also a connection there. You mentioned that you'd first seen me when I was taking some photos at Salamoth years back.
Yep.
And both of these seem like, and you were there with your dad.
Yep.
And I think you showed up in one of the photos. Both of these time frames seem like they were, you know, at least prior or, you know, on the cusp of you guys even thinking about a brewery yourself.
For sure.
It's an interesting time frame in like Chicago beer history in
my mind. Yeah. No, we had a moment, we did a three-way collab with Miskatonic and Salamoth on the Hobson Oak, which was a very old bur oak tree that we ended up cycling through some beer to bring hopefully some woody notes, because we couldn't turn them into barrels. But the general gist of bringing that up was that when we were brewing it at Salamoth, Jude and I were back talking with Andrew Mason and John Barley, just kind of, you know, shooting the you-know-what. And Jude and I had that moment that was like 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. We were sitting on the other side of the bar looking around at how awesome this was, like with no idea that, you know, we would have a brewery of our own, let alone be brewing with, you know, this brewery that at that point we were just looking up to, like how cool that these guys did this. Yeah. So, I mean, to your point about the different points in time, there have been some really cool things that have come for us from some of those interactions, from listening to your podcast, Troubadour. Like, we had no idea who Troubadour was before we
Troubadour Malting's out in Fort Collins.
Chris Schooley has become a guy who we text, and we're going to, you know, do a collab with him. And when we were out for GABF in Denver, we stopped by when he was roasting some malt. Hmm. Paul Schneider, you know, is now at Cinderlands in Pittsburgh. And when he was in town last time, he came in to do a collab with us. We did a hoppy saison with him. So there are all kinds of very cool touch points, you know, that scale way the heck back to before we were a brewery, which is fun to think about and reminisce.
And I think during that time, I think we were trying to consume as much and look for as much inspiration as that we could find. And there were certain places that I think that we are grabbing it from. I think, you know, as much as we are, you know, maybe like we are learning about the industry or learning what it meant to start a brewery or what it would take to start a brewery and then open up a brewery, what I probably just learning about ourselves as well. There were a lot of different areas that we are keying in on and kind of taking in and internalizing, but also using as motivation, and probably the biggest thing as inspiration. Mm-hmm. Trying to just kind of be and get in touch and dig in with, you know, where we thought we wanted to go
That phase is so full of like fear and excitement in equal measure,
stress.
Right? And like it'll change from one minute to the next. And so there's this insatiable hunger for knowledge and certainty, you know, even though you know you can't really get it, like you still try.
Yep.
Like you can't shut it down.
And the little bit of like naivete like just drives you.
You
have no idea. You're just ignorant to a couple important things and you still drive forward.
Yeah, there's many times looking back even in the history of Good Beer Hunting where I'm just like, I'm really glad I didn't know any better.
Right.
We talk about that all the time.
Wouldn't have done it.
We talk about that all the time. Yeah. And we were working full-time jobs while doing this as well and starting families.
Yeah.
And we timed it out by only having one tank. You know, I mean, right now that seems like an eons ago.
Yeah.
You know, we think about 105, 110 cases worth of beer, and it's like, well, no wonder you were able to move that. But the truth is we still had to work really hard to move that.
Yeah.
You know, like there were a lot of points of inspiration along the way where maybe it caused us to change path. Like you mentioned Spiteful before and really focusing on freshness. I remember, you know, Beer Temple posting something about three-day-old alley time.
Yeah.
And we were like, well, our beer isn't that fresh. How do we mess with that? You know, and that spawned our interest in mobile canning and how do we get our beer up quicker and self-distribution. And, you know, in retrospect, certainly it seems like the obvious choice, but that all came from us absorbing as much as we possibly could and trying to make a smart decision as a brewery, especially ones that wanted to focus on hoppy beers. Like freshness is key, right?
Yeah, sure.
And it was all relative. I mean, a 15 barrel tank, 100 cases, but to us that was
so much.
That
beer.
Was a lot, and things are probably only as difficult as your experience level at the time or what you're used to. I mean, yeah, that was insane for us. I mean, how are we going to get out 100 cases? People are interested in 100 cases of our beer.
It's also one of those things, like the freshness thing was Spiteful, where it's like, yeah, that's like an exciting idea. And at that point, it was kind of a new idea. People were just starting to kind of like clue into the idea that you could get beer that fresh and that it might mean something.
Yeah.
Right? Like this was a huge conversation that's still going on between consumers and producers about like what freshness is, why it matters, and how it's achieved.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also like a kind of a matter of constraint. Like when you're a brewery the size of Spiteful, like one of the few levers you can pull is like, well, I can drive this beer over to the shop right now.
Yep.
Right. And now I have the freshest beer on the shelf and I can talk about that.
Yep.
Because you can't talk about all these other things because you don't have the capacity to even do most of those things.
Right.
Yep.
But you can talk about the things that are within your control. And so like, it's always a balance of figuring out like, what are the things that you're at a disadvantage for that you can actually turn into advantages?
Yep. What can we highlight? What are we already doing that we could highlight?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or what are our advantages? And let's you know, let others know about that.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just a matter of getting customers to even care about that thing, right?
Sure.
People were not talking about freshness back then that way. But very quickly, within 6 to 8 months, I would say, like, it was just like a zeitgeist. It was just a meme in people's heads of like, well, now I want the freshest thing I can get. What's the freshest thing on the shelf, Chris? Give me the freshest thing.
They heard about it enough, right? And then they tasted it probably too, and it validated it.
Yep.
To some degree of necessity, when we started canning, we didn't have fridge space either.
Yeah.
Like, cause
we were
working on a brewery that took up most of the fridge space they had. So we were trying to pre-sell it, you know, hey, this is our first can, we're canning on this day, we self-distribute so we could just bring it on by, how many would you want? And that kind of slowly but surely became our model of, hey, this is what's coming down the pipe.
Well, now you're combining freshness and exclusivity, basically. These are all the things that happened in very quick succession over the last few years.
Yeah.
It's funny, too. I mean, we're definitely, I don't know that people would know it, or that you'd be able to take away, but I mean, we're definitely a product of those times or certain times in the breweries that kind of opened up. And you know, it's probably you're mostly affected by what's going around you. That's all you know is you know, we were planning and opening up a brewery while maybe that third wave of Chicago brewers were opening. So I mean, we were paying attention to what they were doing.
Yeah.
So very much influenced by that.
Well, every generation ends up with having kind of a different idea of what a brewery is.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. Like the sort of the form that you see in your mind when you picture a brewery is different for every generation. How beer gets sold is a different idea for every generation. And some of those things get internalized to the point where they can't adapt with the next phase of those ideas.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like we still have producers today that are struggling to adapt and evolve to today's consumer who has a very different set of principles and desires when it comes to a beer.
Right.
Because they're in their minds, you know, a brewery is like this big place that makes a lot of beer and then puts it on trucks and rolls it out across the country. And like, but you're going to have the same problem eventually. And maybe you've already kind of felt it in yourselves of like the beer world you were born into has become your imprint.
Sure.
You're like, this is what a brewery is and how it works. And these are the options.
Yeah.
But there's going to be more options coming.
Right. Well, I mean, it's empowering. It's empowering now that maybe then it wasn't like really highlighted that there was an option to stay small if you wanted to. But all like some of the flexibility I think we've been given as small brewers, and whether it starts with self-distribution and whether you start to see producers from around the country where you know, you did have to sign on with the distributor. You did have to make one or two of the same beers. You did have to get that out in mass. And then you see others where they've pared that down. It's smaller. You have a little bit more control. You have more connect, you know, more connections. That wasn't apparent a couple years ago. Uh-huh. So now I think just the idea that there's an option to do that if we wanted to is great.
Yeah,
also that there's a ceiling somewhere too, but
sure.
Like yeah. to what we can do. I mean, you know, can we make more beer? Yeah. But I mean, that eventually probably goes away too. So,
mm-hmm. So reminds me of Pete Bissell in the op-ed he wrote for us talking about how people would come into his tiny little tap room and be like, you know, like point at Allagash across the street and be like, you could be like that someday. And he's like, well, that's a cool aspiration, but right. like that's yeah. not right. who we're going to be at right. any point.
Right. No. You know? Well, I mean, like when we, it probably is like, you know, you're home brewing and you want to make every style. Jared and I bonded and came together, and I think our love of beer like was centered around Three Floyds. So going to the brew pub and drinking everything on their menu. Yeah. And while they're very hoppy, made a wide range of styles, two brothers at the time too. So, I mean, those are the two big those are the two big examples that we have.
Both of which are nothing like you.
No.
That couldn't be more opposite.
And then I think, you know, the first time Jared gave me this was in 2010, he gave me a farmhouse beer, and him and I would debate what that actually meant.
Oh, no.
You know? It was just like, what are you talking about? What is a farmhouse beer? But that got into, like, Saison, and, you know, the first Saison that I had was a Saison by Three Floyds, and that was Rabid Rabbit. But then that led into us going down, you know, the world of Saison. So it's like, we're going to be Saison brewers, you know? So it's like, you hold that into you, but you're like, no, we're not going to be Saison brewers as much as we love Saison, you know? And then that evolves.
Your pronunciation keeps changing every time you say it. Like, Saison. It gets a little bit more and more.
Yeah, yeah.
Saison. Saison. Like motherland.
Saison.
Yeah, I'm interested now. So let's jump ahead to kind of where you're at now. Now I know that you're brewing at Miskatonic. That's basically what I know of your model now, is that you're brewing out of their space.
Yep.
Which, again, is sort of like two worlds, not clashing, I don't want to say, but like two very different perspectives on a portfolio and two different audiences and two different ways of going to market. They go through distribution. You guys are still self-distro. You're making mostly hoppy beers and big stouts. They're making classic little styles. Tiny things like a rye ale, like Catch Penny, which is one of my favorite beers in the world.
Love that beer.
So you're two very different models, you know, as brands and as portfolios, but existing in the same space and finding a way to kind of work together to make it possible. Yeah. Tell me about that arrangement. Like, how did that come about? How did you get to know those guys? Like, what was the impetus, and how's it going?
Super gnarly. I don't know how Josh got wind, but we used to brew out of another brewery who was starting to fall on some hard times, or some of their ownership was in the news. So we kind of became apparent that our time brewing out of that brewery was going to come to a close. So we are kind of keeping a measured eye on that. So we're probably just carving a beer at one point. I got an email from Josh over at Miskatonic, who caught wind of the idea that we may need a new home.
Yeah.
Jer and I were going to be pouring at Sierra Nevada's beer camp that summer, which would have been 2 years ago, I think. So it was one of those like, yeah, like, thanks for reaching out. I think it was still up in the air as far as we were thinking, but, we needed to keep our options open, and we were interested that someone approached us with the idea of being able to keep it going. So Josh stepped over, by our table and, you know,
opened at the Sierra Nevada Fest.
And that's when we all met for the first time. And that just kind of got the ball rolling to discuss, hey, like, you know, we may have a new home to make beer as an alternating proprietorship.
Yeah.
They're super gnarly. Gerald, take over on this, but the relationship is so awesome. I mean, I could talk about it, but I know you got stuff.
There were a few months there where we didn't even know, you know, if we were going to be able to dry hop our beer, let alone package it and get it out of there.
Yeah. I mean, the kind of beers you're making are just fundamentally different than the beers that they're making.
I'm talking about at the previous situation. Yeah. We had that anxiety. We didn't know if we were going to be out of market for 9 to 12 months. Well, you know, we had to get our own brewery up to going. So there was literally kind of a big fat question mark. And then
I forgot that's where you were. Was it Aquanaut, which was connected to Botrus?
I think I ran into you there too at like a Brooklyn
Beer.
Steve Hindy had something.
Man, that was a that was a shame that the, just as a quick side note, like it was a real shame that went away because he was a good brewer.
Yeah,
and it was through no fault of his own.
No, no.
It was just like tangential ownership from this other company that just like ran into a nightmare scenario.
Great guy. We keep in touch with him too.
We just interviewed Peter Frost yesterday.
Right on.
Who wrote the expose on that guy?
I threw it all out there.
Jesus.
But awesome ESB, awesome coffee.
That ESB was awesome.
So good. Was that the Search? I think.
I think so. Yeah.
A great mild coffee porter. He was one of the. Well, Solemn Oath was. They did. I think Butterfly Flash Mob was a Belgian beer with Mosaic. I think maybe. I could be wrong, but I know for sure he made a beer called like Stella by Starlight that was Mosaic Belgian yeast. Awesome beers.
Yeah,
he kicked out awesome beers. So anyways,
we
keep in touch with him too. We love that guy. But at the end of our time there, our production was pretty erratic.
Yeah.
You know, there would be some times where we would fill his tanks, so we'd go from like 15 to 60 to 45 to 70. And we were just really trying to feel out how much beer we could actually make and move.
Yeah.
And the reason for me bringing that up is when Josh came to us, it was consistency. He was like, we can lease you two tanks.
Yep.
And that gave us a steady of 60 barrels a month.
And we knew what we were going
to
be
doing. We knew what we were going to do. Like, we just had to pick a hop combo, pick our name, like, be smart about what we wanted to do and when. But that was a super exciting moment for us because it was like the heavens opened. Like, just kidding, you don't have to be out of market for an entire year. You can keep doing what you're doing with more volume and consistency at Miskatonic. And slowly but surely that rolled into a little bit more and a little bit more. And that kind of got us to where we were at. But
well, whenever you have too many options, like when you're talking about like how much beer can and should we be putting into market is a hard question to answer, right? Like finding out what your demand curve looks like is really difficult.
Yep.
Especially in a market like beer where it fluctuates so much. Mm-hmm. To have somebody come and say this much.
Yep.
All of a sudden everything else can work off of that one constraint that you've just given yourself, right? Like that's sort of like what putting together a strategy or scenario planning is about. It's like you put a stake in the sand and you see how it affects everything else about the business.
Right.
Sometimes you just have to pick one constraint and lock it in.
Sometimes you have to do that.
Yeah. And we didn't know, you know,
and
even
you assess it later.
It was 2 months and not 9 to 12, but we didn't know if people were going to forget about us over those 2 months because we didn't have beer in the market. And so it took us a couple months before we were able to take it from point B to point C, but just going from A to B with Miskatonic was a cool couple months of like almost re-entering the market as an existing.
Yeah, what was that like when you finally came back with beer ready to sell again after that time period?
It was kick-ass.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, it was refreshing. It felt like we hadn't missed a beat. We felt like the beers we were cranking out of there were a little bit different, but equally exciting.
Yeah.
And it kind of, I think, helped redefine us as in terms of like where we were selling and how much we could give and what hops we could use. It really just kind of affected everything we were doing.
Spot on. I think it helped that the two beers that we kicked out of there first were kick-ass.
Yeah.
I mean,
what were they?
There was one beer called Dun 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 and there was another beer called Craniac. So Craniac was the first time we used a hop new to us called Enigma.
Mm-hmm.
And Dun 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 was the first time where we just said, like, screw it. We're going to stop being cute. We're going to use all the hops that we know are bangers and throw them in one beer. So it was the first time we had assembled a hop bill that was Galaxy, Citra, and Amarillo.
Yeah.
It was like, no brainer. Let's go.
And then Craniac was Nelson and Enigma. It was just weird as hell. But in a good way.
It was like rotten Chardonnay. You know?
Yeah.
It was pretty cool.
Two very contrasting beers that were both hazy, both big, and with two very different look and feels of artwork that felt like it was in the same family.
There was maybe some symbolism going on, too. I mean, I think like there was the idea of a fresh start and the idea of being able to apply everything you had learned up until that point and then having a fresh start. It's probably about like learning how to be like I don't know, like a good boyfriend, and then like, you know, like there's a breakup and then you everything you probably applied, you're like, oh, now I'm a much better, you know what I'm just saying, like now I can apply all these wise strategies to make sure I probably don't mess up like this relationship. Not that I had any issues with the relationship. That was the best
I think it's an analogy most young men can connect with.
Right.
Anybody who's been in a relationship, honestly, can understands the power of the reset moment.
Right. Right. But it was the first time that we had wrapped a pallet and then loaded two pallets on a van and delivered it as well. So for us, that was a big moment.
Yeah. And Miskatonic operates a tap room, so there's somebody there every day, you know, from 8 to 5 or you know, even later on the days their tap room is open. So we got an inside look from some really cool dudes on how that type of brewery mm-hmm. works, because yeah. Aquanaut didn't have that tap right. room, and they were doing production only as well. So we've had the fortune of like learning from those guys. Whereas to your point about two very widely different approaches, they've mm-hmm. been able to learn a couple things from us and what we're doing and why. And I don't know, it's just been a really cool, for lack of a better term, like symbiotic relationship that has just worked well for everybody.
Yeah.
You could say, you know, classic styles versus new style or hazy double IPA. But I think like when you kind of bring it down to like most common denominator, first off, we all have an appreciation for classic styles. We have an appreciation for history and tradition. So, just because the majority of our beers that we make, are hazy double IPAs doesn't mean that we're not drinking anything else yeah. too. So one, I mean, I think personally for all of us, the ability just to drink their Kolsch or their rye IPA or, just kettle kind of like, sour. Yeah, kettle sours was great. But we're no different in the sense that like we're all after the same thing. They bring with them like a wealth of knowledge, and I find them to be really
good teachers too.
Very yeah. much so.
Like those dudes can talk about stuff in a way that is like super relatable and fun to understand.
Yeah, yeah. And we're willing to be sponges. So yeah. we're as much, I mean, and I think in any relationship you pick up on process, how would you do this? We do it like this and back and forth. And they're just cool people. I mean, they're just cool people. And it's great to be able to talk with somebody else about this. I mean, anytime we get hops or they get hops or we get these ingredients, we'll share them, we'll smell them. You know, we might go and order something that they did. They might go and order something that we did. They've started to kick out a couple like hazy brews, and they're tasty beers.
I bet.
They're tasty beers.
With a ton of respect though to like pick their own lane too.
Yeah.
Though. They're not mm-hmm. just looking at our website and being like, oh, Citra and Mosaic work for them, we'll do that one. Like they took painstaking efforts to be like, you guys haven't used this combo yet, and okay, we're gonna use this yeast strain instead of what you guys use, and just really try to carve their own path, which I really appreciated yeah. because it would have been super easy for us to be like, oh, Ketchpenny's delicious, let's make a hazy
yeah.
rye session.
And let's be honest, vice versa. Like, that happens sometimes in relationships
right.
like this.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Like if it's not really on the up and up and like people seeing eye to eye on it, like you become more than just sponges for knowledge. Like you really right. just start to take things and go make them your own and brand them yourself. Like,
right.
That's really unfortunate when that happens.
We're very appreciative that they care.
Yeah,
you know, about
sure.
that angle, because vice versa, we care about it too, and we want to be good tenants, and it would be very easy for them to not care as much about being good hosts,
yeah.
you know, so to speak. So,
and they've been so kick-ass. We made a hazy saison, and we made a classic saison, and we had never free rose a tank. We had never allowed a beer to ferment, and then after a couple days,
gotta believe
notch it up. And it, I mean, the questions were, so, you know, have you used this yeast strain? What day, like when did you know to rise? How high did you let it rise to? I mean, stuff like that. So, yeah.
I think as we push a little bit into other styles that we like kettle sours, like
mm-hmm.
AJ and Josh will be the first people we go to.
Yeah.
You know, yours is delicious. We want to do something different, but like we have a lot to learn about these specific styles, and so they wouldn't even think twice about.
So let's talk about what happens in the next.
Can I say one
yeah,
thing
sure.
real quick? If they're listening, what they've allowed. I mean, we're very cognizant of, you know, what they've allowed us to do. You
yeah.
know, which
yeah.
is make beer and sell beer. So yeah. I mean, like super supreme thanks
yeah,
to them,
time.
And then being so kick ass about it too. You know, and making awesome beer. So.
GBH is underwritten in part by New Belgium Brewing, an employee-owned craft brewery with the oldest continuous sour culture in America. With New Belgium, we're bringing you a new series of stories called Into the Wild. Wild and sour ale in America is a story all its own, and we're still in those early foundational chapters. These are stories about how these beers challenge and inspire the brewers and drinkers who seek them out. GBH is also underwritten by Guinness, who we're collaborating with in a new series called Mother of Invention. Stories devoted to illuminating innovation in the brewing world that impacts the beer in your hand in unexpected ways. Guinness just officially opened their first purpose-built brewery in the U.S., out in Baltimore County, where they have a 2 and 10 barrel system that makes a wide spectrum of contemporary styles served in the taproom only. And they have a 100 hectoliter system, where they're scaling up some of their latest recipes for national distribution in the U.S., like the recently reinvented Blonde Ale and American Style IPA. You should visit, have a seat in their epic beer garden, and tour the historic distillery site, the first legal distillery after Prohibition in Maryland, right off historic Route 1. And of course, we're also supported by The Fervent Few, a growing community of hundreds of GBH readers, including some professional supporters. From the UK, we have Cloudwater Brew Co., Four Pure Brewing Company, Magic Rock Brewing, Honest Brew, Two Tribes Brewing, Beer Hawk, Northern Monk Brew Co., The 5 Points Brewing Company, London Fields Brewery, Verdant Brewing Company, and Boundary Brewing in Belfast. In the US, we have The Mitten Bar in Ludington, Michigan, Lord Hobo in Massachusetts, 1911 Established Cider and Spirits from New York, Hops and Grain in Texas, Tilted Barn Brewery in Exeter, Rhode Island, Proclamation Ale in Warwick, Rhode Island, Old Nation Brewing in Williamston, Michigan, National Craft Beer Retailer, Craft Beer Cellar, and Daredevil Brewing in Indianapolis. And then there's Devil's Peak of Signal Hill Products in Cape Town, South Africa, and Stone and Wood Brewing Company along the far eastern shore of Australia, all supporting us through their monthly Pro Tier subscriptions. You can join the Fervent Few by visiting goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew. Let's talk about what happens in the next phase, whether it's this year or a couple years from now for you guys. 2019 is a topsy-turvy year for a lot of people. You guys have found some stability with a with an alternating proprietorship partner, which is awesome. But what do you want that next phase to be from a model standpoint, a relationship standpoint? Like, what are you looking to do with Hop Butcher as a brand and a model?
I think first and foremost, we want to make more beer.
Okay.
I don't know that you can ever comfortably talk about one path versus another until you feel good about the amount that market can bear.
Yeah.
And right now we've been in the fortunate position of not being able to make enough beer to get into all the places we want. We're really can heavy. There are a lot of draft accounts that we're saying we'd love to as soon as we have beer, but we're not there yet. Mm-hmm. So there's some comfort level finding for us about how much beer we want to make, how far we want to go, and how much our capacity allows us to do it at Miskatonic.
What do you think you kind of top out at in terms of like your ability to make it there?
Oh, I don't even know. It's like $1 million question for Jude and I right now, honestly. I think that, it's still the beginning of 2019. Maybe if we had more time, we would have had it in December of 2018. But I think we feel good about how we've kicked the year off, knowing that he and I need to sit down and kind of talk about where we go from here. We just haven't gotten there yet.
We're in every tank that we could brew into there.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it's not like other than bringing on additional equipment, which is has to be fair to Miskatonic, and is there a space, and what does can the infrastructure support it?
Mm-hmm.
Do we have the infrastructure to support making that beer, getting that beer out?
Yeah, I mean, if you get to a healthy position with volume and you figure out where that's at and what your demand curve looks like out of Miskatonic, is that potentially like a locked-in scenario for you, or does it have to go to another phase? Like, is a third phase sort of like a foregone conclusion for you guys? Like, do you move into the taproom kind of space? Do you move into your own facility? Do you continue to operate like this? I guess I'm curious what the scenarios might look like for you.
So, I mean, the goal has always been, since day one, since we probably had our first beer at a taproom at one of our favorite breweries, was to be able to have that same experience ourselves and share that experience with others.
Yeah.
So the goal has always been a tap room.
Mm-hmm.
So to have our own physical brewery where a culture can spring up, where we have our own offices and we come into and we just where all of that starts to build up and that ethos starts to come, those would be the two goals.
Yeah.
But with that comes a price. First off is, what's that going to cost? We have families, we have wives, we have kids. What if it all goes down? How much beer do we have to sell? Can we sell that amount of beer? Have we ever sold that amount of beer? So those are the things that we think of.
So it sounds like you have some healthy caution right now going into 2019 about what's achievable in the near term.
And, I think the thing that like Jared and I would agree is we've always been pretty conservative, right? And we've always taken a measured approach, or before we've made a decision that says, We thought this is what this would entail. Let's see that this can play out before we go ahead and do it. And I think, you and I talk about this all the time, that's what this last year was let's see that there's demand. Let's see that we can make that amount of beer. We've never done this before. Let's see what it's like. So I think we had a good year as far as that goes. So I feel that gives us confidence in moving forward or taking that risk. The other scenario, though, I guess, I'm not saying this to anybody that would buy our beer and think that we wouldn't take this, but I guess the other scenario is, yes, you never, I guess, depends on what your goals are, but I guess you never have to go you never have to set out on your own. I guess you can continue to make beer somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, it's an option.
Yeah,
it is.
Nobody would really think about that as an option before, right? The world's gotten very comfortable with these kind of arrangements, sure, and like following brands and people and particular products in a way that is varied, more varied than ever.
We didn't talk about the two breweries that probably sprung up at that same time we were talking about. The first one was probably Michelar, right?
Yeah.
Like, even, I mean, you know, the world has changed in terms of,
yeah, big time,
the idea. So, but yeah. I mean, that's not what we want to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
we want to bring people in. Yes, we want a brewery. We want people in.
We just want to feel max comfort before we take that leap, and that's what he and I are working through right now.
Everybody kind of comes from an experience, you know, in business or as an employee at somebody else's business before they launch into something like this. Where did you guys come from that gives you that kind of emotional point of view on what you want to do? Like, what gives you that sort of like functional conservatism around, you know, being cautious, but also being like excited?
Right.
So I think that, so we're both sports business, sports marketing backgrounds. That's where we met.
Yeah.
Previous job, Chicago Rush.
Yeah.
Arena football, right? Chicago Rush.
Arena football.
Where we were in sales. So in terms of like sales and marketing and feeling comfort with us carrying that load for Hop Butcher, that's where I feel like we need the least amount of help, because that's where he and I kind of function best. But from a conservativeness standpoint, I think it's just a healthy fear of letting the families down, and, you know, you sign over your house, your car, and everything you own, and then if it goes south, what happens next?
Yeah.
So as long as you keep in mind who you're doing it for and what your end goals are, that has driven a lot of, we feel, very smart decisions, even if we do get pounded with the question, why don't you have a tap room? Why can't I buy, you know, a 4-pack directly from you? And we've done our best to kind of step up and mitigate that with the geographical reach of our self-distribution and how much beer we're trying to continue to make. But it's something that I don't think is ever going to go away. You know, like, we want to make our wife and kids proud and have good news for them, not bad news. Like, hey, honey, we're losing the house because we can't sell enough beer.
Yeah.
But certainly we recognize opportunity too, which is what's exciting about this year and beyond, is Jude and I, correct me if I'm wrong, we feel like we've proven something. You know, we have a lot more to prove, but we've proven that we can continue to make better beer and we can keep people interested and excited and keep our accounts happy, even though we're not always giving them everything they want. We're continuing to use the brewery as a vehicle for us. It's a creative, you know, creative output for us, whether it's a name or a hop combo or whatever. We're telling that story and people are responding in a positive way. Like, that just all kind of snowballs for us in terms of taking it to the next step and the next step. We just didn't want to go from A to Z, you know, and give up the equity and half the equity in the brewery and then be like, oh, now we got to dig ourselves out by figuring out what kind of beer to excite people with. We wanted to start and say, we're already doing this.
Yeah, you don't have to brew to solve problems.
Right. And there's real life examples out there. And it, like, probably as unintentional as it was, and you pay attention to the news and you see not so good stories out there about other breweries, and you kind of, if you internalize it and you take a look and you say, well, we're kind of in a good position, and you don't want to mess it up. You know, we're suddenly somewhere small or medium, where you have a little bit more of a say on what goes on, and you can kind of, you know, flex your muscles or stretch out a little bit and, you know, continue with your independence and stuff like that. You know, you don't want to get to a point where, you know, you said, shit, we lost, you know, we had a good thing going and we effed it up, you know, like, we, you know, like, and you lost it. So it's kind of, you find yourself in a position where you're saying, like, the going's good.
Yeah.
The going's good right now, and everyone's happy, and like, maybe
let's let it
go.
Be good for a minute.
Yeah, let's let it be good. And God forbid we take it too far, and then we're looking at each other like that, the Mel Brooks movie where he's like, "What, life stinks?" Or like, we're looking at each other and we're just like, "Oh my gosh, like, what did we do? Like, we had it in the palm of our hands and we screwed it up."
Who are some of the breweries you look at that that feel like good, you know, not necessarily that they follow your model, but they're good mentors just from the way that they work in helping you understand, you know, some of those principles, like what those what models do you watch, or what breweries do you watch that are interesting to you in that way?
So this is going to sound maybe potentially crazy, but I would say 6 or 7 years ago, I was in San Fran with my wife for a work trip.
You gonna say Cellar Maker?
I'm gonna say Russian River because I was in San Fran and wanting to get my hands on Pliny the Elder fresh. And it happened to be like a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday, and I started making phone calls from the hotel room asking if they had any. And almost to an account, every single one of them was like, ha, very funny, we're fresh out, but if you wait until Monday, if you're here that long, we'll have some. And that was cool because I felt like they had dialed in their distribution and production to a point where they knew how to keep it fresh. They knew how quickly each account was going to sell through, however, whatever they delivered. But they weren't frustrating people by constantly being out. And as a beer fan back in Chicago, I was kind of there with Three Floyds because that's what we were drinking.
Yeah.
But if you didn't know your Whole Foods guy and you weren't standing there on a Wednesday at 2 o'clock when the truck showed up, you weren't getting one of those two cases of Gumball Head. Yeah. Now, I say that completely aware of the irony of some of our beers, that if they're not doing that exact same thing.
Totally.
So it sucks to say that and realize that we're causing a similar frustration. But
it's an easier question to answer knowing that.
Trust us.
We don't want to frustrate people.
Well, there's a very different emotional takeaway of like, haha, you can never get it, and it'll be here on Monday. Like,
right.
There's one is just rejection and exclusion. The other one is anticipation. You know,
sure.
I'll try to help you get it.
Right.
So yeah, we do try to remain communicative with people who talk with us on social media because we want them to know that we get it. And we don't, like, we want the demand to be there because we want to continue to make beer and tell our story. But we are trying to make more beer for the purposes of frustrating fewer people, first and foremost.
Yeah.
You know, if we could make, you know, 300 barrels of Neon Green Relish and know that it would move in 2 weeks everywhere we go, and we had the capacity to do that, yeah, we'd do that. But we are tied to the environment that we have, but we are maxing that out in hopes of frustrating the fewest amount of people.
Yeah.
That's part of the answer in terms of growth is we want as many people to be able to enjoy our beer. So in terms of like how much to grow, well, I mean, I guess the answer would be, I don't know if it's how good of an answer it is, but however many people are out there that you know want to enjoy our beer, or however many people that we're missing out on, we want to have as many people get to be able to enjoy it. So I mean, that's where I think the desire for growth would be. There's still people out there that aren't getting it. We want to get that their hands.
That Russian River story paired with the Spiteful story, I think, at least from my perspective, tells the story of how we got here better than anything
I don't think there's a better grassroots story in Chicago beer than Spiteful.
Yeah.
Like a small and as insane
in a basement.
Three and a half barrel system.
And they did it for so long.
Yeah.
So long. Hand rolling cans, right?
With the with the, I mean, they were wheeling things in and out of tiny rooms to make room for stuff.
Yeah.
They were so patient and did it for so long and grinded.
Yep.
And then they finally got their finally got their brewery and tap room. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those two paired, though, really felt like the core of inspiration in terms of freshness, in terms of how you work with your accounts to understand. You know, and for us, maintaining that churn of new with a little bit of experimental, with a little bit of tried and true, and continuing to push that up in a very thought out way so that we're not overextending ourselves is kind of our MO, which is exciting because it feels like the right approach. It feels like consumers are responding in a positive way. And it's encouraging as Jude and I sit down and not only talk about 2019, but 2020 and 2021. And how do we sustain this for the long term and not just be that flashy new thing that goes away after a few years?
Yeah.
So that's been kind of our pledge, you know, to each other, whether we're talking about beer names or we're talking about what styles to make. Should we make more pails? Should we make more dessert stouts? Should we not? Should we focus on hazy double IPAs? Like, where are our clear and clean beers coming from, and how do they pair up against breweries we like drinking, like Half Acre? You know, like, they've been stalwarts of the scene for a long time, and why? And we're really trying to dive into those answers to those questions and kind of taking some of that for our own, you know, intelligence and making smart decisions.
Yeah.
We know what it's, and we also know what it's like to buy beer and seek beer and drink beer and have questions about beer. So I think that we either still remember and we still know like how we wanted to be talked to or treated, or how we wanted to see that conversation go down. And I feel that, so that's who we try to be. So some of it is born out of that. We'll can up a tank of beer, we'll get it on a truck. We, not only is there the beer with these hops, but it's also where it's going, and we have the power of social media. So, you know, so we'll get it out. We know where it's going. We control it. We make the stops. We know when it's going to get there. We know who's receiving it. And so we just try and kind of treat others from a distribution standpoint.
And then you kick back on the couch and watch it roll in and on
the way we wanted to do it. But I mean, we're down to answer. So that's when you see the untapped ratings.
Yeah. When's the next one that's going to roll out that you get to kick up on the couch and watch?
Later in the month. January 29th.
Later 30th. In the month. We're stoked too.
Yeah. We got
cherry vanilla milkshake.
Oh boy.
We have I didn't bring it, but we did a collab with Arcane Distillery out of New York. And what he does, he works out of the same facility as Interboro.
Okay.
And he will take his hop trube and distill it. So it's a little different from other models where you're just shipping hops, they're distilling the hops. Like, he's taking beers that have been done and are kind of tried and true, just taking the trube out of there, and then you get whatever blend that was.
Yeah.
So he came into town and he gave us a number of different options, and the table was just like full of bottles and little cups, and we were 50% this, 40%
essential
that,
oil 10% and hydrosol
that.
And beers. Yeah.
And like, I'm just sitting there at the end of the table looking at this cup of oils, and like the little dots are just moving on their own because of surface tension. Just like geeking out over that. And I'll be like, all right, sorry, what was this blend? And it was a cool experience. David was awesome. But in short, he left us enough to do the beer that we did, which was Traveling Scientist. And that was the first pale in a while that we had done. And
it was the first
maybe our highest rated pale, and it was delicious. That kind of set in motion our love of doing maybe some lower ABV hoppy beers, but also doing more than one version of Traveling Scientist. So that's my long way of saying we're re-releasing Traveling Scientist with Galaxy and Galaxy Hydrosol, because he had left us some of that to do another version.
We need another half an hour for this.
And vacuum distilled hop oils.
Oh my God, that stuff is...
They're another... I mean, it's just another level, like when you smell it.
Yeah, it was like I said, just like you walk out of their tap room. We're at Miskatonic doing it, and they were closed that day, so no one else was in there. You walk out, and then you walk back in, and you just get hit with this wave of like bright hop expression.
And you'll burp later in the night.
And they're best beer burps of all time. So like that beer was sold and we got it out, but you know, you share it with friends, and I would be like, yeah, this is Traveling Scientist. And before I'd say anything else about the beer, I'd be like, this will be the best beer burps you ever have in your life. And it's because of the oils. Take it.
It's like what hops will taste like in the year 3000. Like it's insane. And Mirabal.
And Mirabal. Yeah, return of Mirabal.
Citra Centennial Hazy Double IPA.
Yeah.
My takeaway from this is that a couple of guys who came up through arena football know how exciting something can be, and you can go for it and have a lot of fun and be connected with your fans and like do this thing, but also it's still arena football. You have to be very cautious with how fast you grow it.
Yes.
And do the things that make sense.
But being genuinely excited about what we're making and drinking, even if we are drinking other things, is a cool feeling. You know, like it feels very endemic. It feels very natural that like we're not just making something that sells. Like, and we're not just making something because like that was our background and what we learned to do. We both shifted from one career to another because we found the beer industry interesting and we wanted to brew things that we love to drink. Which is a cool story to be able to tell, because, you know, like there's no preparation for something like this. Like you ask us a question and it's like, here's the truth. Like, let me just spill it out on your table for you.
Yeah. We didn't spill anything today.
No farmers.
We're very fortunate that we like hops, and a lot of people like hops as well.
Thanks for listening this week, folks. This is GBH's founder, Michael Kaiser. If you find value in the content that GBH produces, we'd love to hear it. Rate the podcast, tweet at us, send us an email, share it with a friend, whatever makes sense for you. That feedback goes a long way and helps others find us too. And if you're feeling generous, we started a subscription club for GBH readers called The Fervent Few, where you can contribute financially to the content you love and get access to exclusive gear, our community forum, and we invite you to share your experiences and opinions on a weekly topic. It's been a great way to bring our readers together with our writers for some compelling discussion, and you should join. If you'd like to support GBH, visit goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew or click on the link in our show notes. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true. Poor liberal folks. Have a great week.